Good day, South Dakota, and welcome to Dakota Midday Tech Radio. I'm SDPB Online's Ken Osborne. SDPB is going to update you with the latest news, and then following the news, we'll discuss the latest in tech, and we'll find out what all the heartburn is about Heartbleed, and of course, we'll take your time for questions or comments. Connect with us at Facebook, facebook.com/techradio. Message us on Twitter at SDPB, and our phone number is 800-524-3604. The email address midday@sdpb.org. Dakota Midday Tech Radio is on the air after this news. Welcome to Dakota Midday Tech Radio for the 11th of this month, 2014. Our 800 number is 1-800-524-3604. You can also drop us an email. Send that to midday, M-I-D-D-A-Y, at sdpb.org. Today's panelists, Mac guru Joel Brovelite will join us, SDN's sales engineer Amos Asop, and from Peer, Jeff Litterick, a technology integration specialist. He is on the line with us today as well. A reminder to listeners, if you'd like a list of the links that we're going to talk about on today's show, they'll be posted to the web shortly, along with the show notes. Hit the Facebook page at facebook.com/techradio. And I'll just tell you, go there now. There's a good article on this whole Heartbleed thing, and we're gonna dissect that today on the show. But a good basis to start reading, and if any websites that you frequent are on the list, that is all up to date, and on the Facebook page is a link. So I'll just go ahead and send you there now. While you're on the Facebook page, if you'd like to jot us a note, ask a question, or have a comment for the show, paste it right there on the Facebook page, and we'll talk about it on today's show. Amos, I want to start with you. Good day, sir.
Hello, Kent.
It's good talking to you again.
You too. It's been a while.
Yes, it has, and we need to get you back on the show. So here you are, and in our big fundraising special today on the 411.
Well, you know, you used to make it pretty easy on me holding it where I worked. It was hard for me to get away.
Yeah, we took the show to you. You didn't come to
right,
the show.
Right.
So yeah. Well, anyway, let's talk a little bit about Heartbleed. We probably need to explain in a little bit of detail, a little bit of background information. This started, it's a software bug, and it started as a program, an update called Heartbeat. So how did we go from Heartbeat to Heartbleed?
Well, the bleed comes in because there's information that is shared that shouldn't be shared. And so I guess the context there is that it's bleeding out. So it started, the security program or the security piece involved here is called OpenSSL. And if you're familiar with, the typical logging into your bank and making sure there's the little padlock and making sure that you're using the secure protocols that every bank uses, as well as a lot of other websites, this is the piece of software that does that. This is the part that does the encryption that keeps you safe and in theory was doing that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was just going to say, it wasn't the encryption that's the problem, right?
Right. No, that's not the problem. there is a vulnerability that allows a specially crafted request to actually pull information off of the server. Now, you know, that information is, it can be random, the information that's being pulled, but there's no limit to how many times you can request that information. And so information in memory on those servers could include things like your username and your password, maybe credit card details, maybe other sensitive information regarding your accounts that you're logged into. And so it's something that came about or came to light on Monday night. That's kind of when the big flurries hit.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, there could have been attacks. There could have been attempts to gain this information. And because this particular exploit does not leave any traces, does not leave any logs, we can't tell if it happened or not up until that point. There's no way to really verify or say, you know, you should go change your password on this website or you're someone who's been a victim of this issue.
Sure.
And so that website that you've got posted on Facebook is a great resource for finding out which websites have fixed their SSL vulnerabilities and going out and making those changes on those sites. Because if they haven't fixed it yet, then there's no sense making the change because it's still possible to be compromised.
Yeah, I want to ask Jeff this. So, Jeff, there are websites like Google, Facebook, YouTube, Yahoo, Netflix, just to name a few that our listeners probably have heard of or use on a regular basis. But there are also websites like Amazon, Twitter, eBay, Apple that aren't affected by this. Why? How is that possible?
Well, the vulnerability was in a very narrow range of software versions. Now, this particular software does run, on good guess estimates, about 85% to 80% of all SSL encryption on the Internet.
Okay.
But only the very newest major version. And a lot of the sites were still running older versions or had modified it, because it is open source and anyone can modify it, had modified it in a way that it reduced the vulnerability or migrated it, like offloading the SSL to specialized hardware where all you could maybe grab were keys and stuff like that. One thing I will note, though, as Amos talked about, we do actually have detection mechanisms in log files to go back for these, and I have had reports that people in the wild, at least from some major sites, have seen this signature of this attack now going back through the logs since last November, at least. So it has been out, and it has been being used for quite a while out there to grab both username, passwords on these sites, also private keys of the sites. It's one of the reasons why it's very important to wait until they fix the site before you change your stuff, because if they've actually compromised the private key, which is one of the things they're looking for in this attack, it means they can decrypt every piece of traffic that goes to that website from everybody. So you really have no protection until they're patched and they change out their key systems and update them. So it's kind of pointless to try to change your passwords and mitigate your data until that has happened for those websites.
And, so, and fortunately, a lot of the main websites have patched. And I would imagine so there is a new current patch. People just aren't reverting to an older version.
Right. And one other thing that, because everyone's kind of focusing on the server side, which is the most dangerous, is all the browsers and clients that this has been built into, i.e. the user programs that run on your desktop, are also vulnerable. And malicious servers can actually pull your computer's memory the same way that hackers are pulling from the servers today. So it can work in either direction. So it's also important for all people out there to update your browsers and stuff and specialized client software as patches come out, too, especially if you're running SSL VPNs. It's very important to patch those if you use that particular type of client software as the patches come out.
A lot of interesting sidebar conversations going on over this, particularly because this happened in 2011. Although, you know, maybe people didn't know that the exploit was available till later. But you know, some people are saying that the NSA has been using this to. You know, obviously get information about people or from people for a while and just kept it under wraps, didn't really let anybody know because it was a way around something, or, you know. So there's I guess, all sorts of conspiracy theories going on out there. And
I can address at least one of them. The person who actually made the mistake in the code, he has been found and he has made a public statement. This wasn't some secret government organization paying this in or hiding this in to beta backdoor servers. It was actually a simple mistake made by a person, and actually was code reviewed, and the mistake was got through the code review into the production line. All it was a very simple mistake. They just forgot to validate a variable on the length, kind of a common programming mistake, not made too often anymore nowadays, but the guy who actually made the mistake and submitted the code fessed up, and it was just an honest mistake. So while the security agencies around the world may have discovered and used it, they did not implant it as a, you know, kind of conspiracy thing.
Right, right. Yeah, like they have in some other instances in the past. But so this is the other interesting aspect that I've been reading about is, you know, people are coming out and saying, you know, okay, so you broke the Internet. Is it really... can it really be that easy for a team of programmers, really, that was working on this? One of them was being paid. The others were, since it's open source, they're contributors. Shouldn't anybody working on something this important all be, you know, paid professionals? And then you would have some oversight then at that. What they're implying is that it would be run at a more professional level with more oversight, and they do more testing, I guess.
On this project, I'll say no, and I'll let Amos speak up here in just a minute. But in reality, it was already code reviewed, and I know many private paid programmers don't even get code reviewed. So it was probably actually this software is considered and still considered one of the more secure ones out there because of the levels they go to and double checking and stuff. It's a tragic bug. It's a really bad bug, but it was an honest mistake, and it could have happened to anybody.
Sure. Okay. Amos, do you have anything else you want to throw in on this? Because I have a feeling we're about to move on.
Well, you know, what you say is a common thought when you say, why isn't this professionally done? Why aren't these paid programmers? Why isn't this done in a corporate-type environment where there's a little more, stricter regulation? But one of the beauties of things being open source and being available for peer review by anyone is that you actually end up with more people who are reviewing things. And this is a rarity when you find a bug this large. Again, it was in the newest version. It was bound to be found sometime. That's really how we found it. Being open source, anybody can take a look at it. And that's the nice part about it, is that eventually these bugs come to light and we're able to get them fixed. This one just happens to be a pretty large one, and it took maybe a little longer than the average Joe bug.
Sure. Joel Brovelite is with us today. Joel, do you have anything you want to throw in on the conversation?
I just want to mention that iOS and OS 10 for the Mac is not included in the vulnerability. That doesn't mean that a website you might use, which is probably the more important thing anyway, might be vulnerable. So, same things all apply, but your personal machine, if you're running a web server or something like that, would not be affected.
Yeah. Before we go to break, I want to bring a couple of things to light. This brings us full circle to a couple of issues that we've talked about on the show many, many, many times, but we probably need to reiterate a couple of really basic things as it relates to security and what you can do at home to help. I guess when you go in and change these passwords. One, don't get an email from somebody saying, hey, there's a big security vulnerability out there. You need to change your password. Click here. Because there's a lot of fraud going around right now, and they use current things in the news like this to go out and solicit new passwords and things from people and to make things even worse. So sort of a fraud alert sort of a thing there. And then we're really finding out that people aren't being really diligent. When I've talked a little bit to folks that aren't extremely tech savvy or want to be about this issue, and I've talked to people locally here in Vermilion. I've talked to people, I guess, around the globe, and they don't seem real concerned about this, and they don't seem real concerned about changing their passwords. And when I quiz them about their passwords, They aren't even real concerned that they use different passwords for different websites. They want to use the same password because it's easy. Is there a way, or are there ways that we can help people improve, I guess, the quality of their passwords and make it easier for folks? Is that even possible?
Well, I will put out one of the ways is to, but I'm going to preface this that at least two of the sites that do this were open to this vulnerability in of themselves. But one thing to use with a unique passwords is to use a password manager, in which, especially ones that create automatic passwords for you. So you basically are, every time you use a password, it's a unique one. It's never reused, and it's stored in a location either up on the internet or on your local computer. And many of them have gone to the internet, though. Like I said, a couple of these websites were vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to remember one password to get in, and then everything else is kind of randomly generated and protected. So that makes it much easier. It's not perfect, because if that one master password gets hacked and they get into your account, they can get to everything. So you really have to make that very strong, very long.
Yeah, it can be a single point of failure.
Yes.
Much like the heart bleed issue is kind of a single point of failure too. And I know which one you're talking about. It's the password manager. One of them is called LastPass, and I happen to use that one. So this was one I was very active in getting my password changed right away. And I, you know, I don't even remember if I can remember what that password is now. But I changed it. And along with a lot of other websites, it kind of was a, you know, not a very pleasant couple of hours to kind of go through all my accounts and change a bunch of passwords. But a password manager can certainly make things better or easier on you.
And this brings up also another thing that helps protect you in these cases. Many sites like Google, was not a concern, even though they were vulnerable to change the password, because I also have second factor authentication with them. So even if they grab that, yes, they could encrypt and de-encrypt, but I can't prevent that at this point, the past. But even if they got my password, they still really can't get into my accounts without me also doing all the stuff to let them in because of the two-factor authentication. I'd get alerts and stuff. So you're also protected somewhat with that. Nothing is a magic bullet, though. Two-factor can still be gotten around, but as you add layers, unique passwords through a password manager, second factor, it just makes it harder and harder for them, and it takes more time, so they're going to move on to other easier targets.
How deep did you go with your second factor authentication? Every time you log in, do you have to authenticate like from your phone? Or
right, I have two things. Every device has to be authorized by Google, and the apps, even on my smartphone, have one-time passwords authorized through Google if they don't allow device authentication. So every device, if I try to get into a new computer, I will get a text message and have to answer it with a passcode in through the website and stuff to allow that through. Mm-hmm. And then I also approve every app independently, like on my smartphone, Google Maps, and all that stuff have their own passwords that are set up through Google as a one-time kind of thing per app, per device. So it's not shared among anything else.
And folks can find this in their, is there a security tab in Google if they want to look into this further? Or
yep. You go into your account, your profile section. If you're using Gmail, it's a little picture of you or your profile picture. And in there's privacy and security settings, and you can set all this stuff up. It can kind of be a hassle, especially if you know, on the iPad, you set up a new app, and you have to go grab your phone to get the text message stuff, but that little inconvenience for the one time you have to do it or two times you have to register it occasionally is outweighed by the security by quite a bit.
Sure. Amos, do you use a password program a piece of software that helps you remember passwords or automatically log in?
I do. We use a corporate one that allows us to share passwords, actually, so that if we've got maybe support accounts or something with various vendors, we can keep that information available to everybody.
Yeah. Give me a couple of names on these, because this interests me. Is it the same company? Is it like LastPass and
yep,
companies like those?
We use a LastPass for that particular function. And then for my own personal stuff, whether it's at home or on my workstation at the office, I use a KeePass, which is a more open source. That's a free version, actually, or a free product. But that's something I use just for my own personal.
Is that a piece of hardware that you plug in, or what's KeePass?
No, that's it's just another piece of software. It's the same thing as LastPass, just a little bit different. Has a few different features. Provides the ability to generate passwords and save passwords, and it'll plug them into web forms for you. And it just doesn't have the same all of the sharing and corporate type functionalities that LastPass has. And so it's something that I've been using years and years and years and years, and I just wasn't willing to give up when we changed technology at the office. So I use two of them.
Sure. Well, we need to take a quick break. When we come back after the break and the fundraising break, we need to talk a little bit about Windows 8 security and iPads and iPods and I guess iTunes and things like that. So we'll have some questions for Joel after this break. And welcome back to Dakota Midday Tech Radio for this 411-2014. Our 800 number is 1-800-524-3604. If you have questions or comments, drop us a line. You can also do that via email, midday, M-I-D-D-A-Y, at sdpb.org. The best way to do that. Our panelists again today are Matt Guru, Joel Brovelite. John T. Myers, I don't think he's probably taking a day off, but he's so busy he can't join us today. We wish John a happy day and a happy weekend. SDN's sales engineer Amos Asip is with us. And from Peer, Jeff Litterick, a technology integration specialist and I guess all around gaming and security and networking kind of a guy. Jeff, I got a question right off the bat for you. We had a listener went out and got a couple of these HP Sleek books. Have you seen these? They're kind of the hybrid laptop, but you can touch the screen like an iPad kind of a device.
I haven't touched one personally, but yes, I know what they are.
So they're running Windows 8. The question is you know they're transitioning off of older machines from back in the day when right out of the box you needed to put software on your computer to make it secure. So they needed, you know, they needed to go out and get Norton or AVG, or they needed to do something firewall-y or something like that. They're coming into these newer machines. I couldn't answer the question. Maybe you can. So Windows 8 out of the box, is that do they need to do anything security-wise, or is what's on there good enough?
Well, I'm going to make this a little bit more general reply because there's really three versions of Windows 8 I'll talk about here real briefly.
Okay.
The first two versions, no, you don't have to. At least at this point in time, there's not a lot of a threat, and that's Windows Phone and Windows, what they call Windows RT, which is basically the tablet version that runs on very low-end tablets. And those are kind of like the Android and iOS devices of the world. They're more locked down. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you don't have security risks and you don't have to patch them, but you don't really have to put antivirus and stuff on them day one. Now, the rest of the world, Windows 8, be it desktop, be it Windows 8 Pro on a Surface tablet, or Windows 8 on these type of devices, is just like Windows 7. It's open. It's a general purpose operating system where programs can install themselves. You should have antivirus protection, at a minimum, just like you would on any Windows XP or Windows 7 device, and you may want to take it up to a higher level with an IDPS or other functions. But you do need to protect Windows 8 machines, except the phones and the RTs, the same as you have protected any Windows machine in the past.
Okay. So that's, I guess that answers the question. Yes, they need to go out and seek a good antivirus, whether it be a paid-for one or a free one. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, what do you use? Do you use free ones or do you pay for one?
Well, at work we use a pay one, a full enterprise protection product that does IDS firewalling and antivirus and malware detection and all that stuff built into one. At home, I actually, because I have stuff pretty much locked down in my browser stuff, I just use the Microsoft one that comes free with it. Just so you know, in Windows 7 you had to activate, but I believe in Windows 8, I'm pretty sure, there's an antivirus already running. It's a free one. It's not the greatest by far in the world. Microsoft supports it. It updates once a month. If that's all you're relying on for security, I would say you need to buy or upgrade to a better free one. There are both free and paid ones that are better than that out there. But it kind of depends on your situation, what you're using it for, and what other security defenses you have in place also. So it can work, the Microsoft one, but if you're just relying on that as your only protection, I would recommend an upgrade.
Okay. Joel, what about on the Mac side of things? Is there a security suite or anything that comes with a Mac? If I went out and bought a new MacBook Pro or a Mini or something like that, is there security software that comes with a Mac, or is that something that a new user would need to purchase?
Well, it depends, you know, more on what kind of security features you'd want. If you wanted an antivirus, for instance, you would need to purchase that. There isn't anything that comes pre-installed on a Mac. That said, there are lots of built-in security features that you really don't directly access. You can set up a firewall on basically all of the ins and outs on your Mac. If you use standard, email, whether it's Apple's email client or Gmail, of course you're going to have virus protection from them. There are several different security packages available, antivirus and that. I don't necessarily recommend one over the other. I would probably maybe go with some of the more popular ones. But no, there's nothing installed beforehand. Although, I'll be honest with you, and I've said this before, I don't use any antivirus software on my Mac, and I never have. And I'm not saying that I recommend that for anyone necessarily. But I've never really been infected by a virus, but I'm also very careful too. So, and honestly, I don't think there are a lot of virus software sold for the Mac, frankly. So, because of that low demand, I don't know that there are as many packages available.
Well,
certainly
I wanted
it's not as vulnerable as Windows.
It's a fair question. I wanted to get that out there for folks if they're considering a purchase of either the new. A new Windows 8 machine or a Mac or something like that, what they'd be coming into. So for fair warning on folks.
Absolutely.
Hey, I had a question about iPods, I should say, that I couldn't answer. And that was this user bought one a couple of years ago at a pawn shop. So not a whole lot of instruction manuals or ways of caring and feeding for those.
Not that they ever really came with any, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, there is that. So this person asked, where's the best place to turn for some help? Finding some music that should be there and maybe
well, there
maybe
should be no music there because any music that would be on there would of course not be yours. So ideally there should be no music there. Assuming it's blank and he just wants to know tips and tricks and how to run it,
yeah.
I think one of the best places is to go to Apple's own website and go to their user forums. There are, of course they have employees that monitor those and kind of groom them to make sure that the information given out isn't bad, or if they need to step in and give an official answer to something, they do that.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are lots of what I would call crazy lurkers that just are very friendly and very helpful and will answer virtually any question or point you in the right direction. I don't know if they're just saints or angels, but if you're patient, you will get your question answered. And a lot of times, if you just do a quick search, you'll find what you want on Apple's user forums. And like I said, they're monitored by the employees there. So if anybody's giving very poor advice or misdirection, that usually gets corrected and or deleted. So that's probably one of my favorite places.
Also asked about maybe a local place in Sioux Falls or in the area. Is there a place?
I mean, I would definitely recommend going to Mac Pros on 41st Street. They can fix any of your iPods or iPhones. They, of course, can give you training and can, maybe sell you a book or point you in the right direction. So that would be my favorite local place to go.
I know they're actually going to buy a new one, newer one, so that they can use the FaceTime to talk to relatives and things like that. And so they probably have lots of questions about that as well. So that's a good local resource they're asking about.
Correct.
Great.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. You sent me a link, and I had seen that that Google Glass was going to be available for a day only. And our resident Glass Bert, is that a word?
It is now.
John T. Meyer is not on the show today, but you want to bring us up to date on what's going on with Google Glass?
Well, I think it's just kind of an awareness promo. April 15th, everybody's
tax
favorite day.
I
think they're kind of just marked, use your tax return to buy a Google Glass, and you don't have to be a super special tech insider person to get a hold of a pair. So you can, for April 15th, one day only, you can buy the newest version of Google Glass. Again, I think just an awareness promo. I would not probably recommend that to, anyone who didn't already have access to it, frankly. Not that it's a bad device, but if you aren't already tapped in, you're probably not the right person for it. honestly. So, and we can, I'd bet dollars to donuts that John, if he were here, would agree with me. Of course, I think that because he's not here.
People
you
are.
Know, and there's,
yeah, go ahead.
There's two things keeping me from jumping on that April 15th date. One is the
$1,500 price tag.
1,500 right. reasons.
Right. And the second is I saw what John looks like when he's wearing them, and you couldn't pay me to leave the house with those on.
Well, now the new version's a little better.
And I have seen they can put them into prescription glasses, in, yeah. and it's still not awesome.
Yeah, neither of those, I think, are the reasons that people ought not use them. I just don't think that your average person's going to find a lot of use for that.
Right, yeah. And I think that's probably why they're allowing this, is I think they are having less spectacular enthusiasm about it than maybe they had expected.
Yeah, and like I said, I think if you are already the kind of person that would have an immediate use or be tapped into that market, you would already have an invite sitting in your box waiting for one. So, again, just think it's an awareness promo so they can get some press. Not a bad idea, frankly.
Are they starting to feel some hot breath in their neck in this arena from, let's see, Facebook, who just bought, is it Oculus? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
So we talked about Oculus last show. But there are others that are trying to advance technology in this arena as well. And are they getting close?
You know, it really comes down to the next big thing is wearable tech. And whether it's wearing it on your face or wearing it on your wrist or any other place, there's a lot of companies that have been pioneers in this, and it's just not done well. It seems like the form factor has a lot to do with it, as well as the price point. But I think that's to be expected. I think at some point somebody's going to figure it out, somebody's going to get it right, and then just due to the way things work, prices are going to come down and things are going to get better. I saw a review. One of the things I was interested in was the Galaxy Gear. That's the watch that pairs with your phone and allows you to send and receive messages and answer calls and take pictures with your watch.
And pretend you're Michael Knight.
Yes. Speak to your watch.
80s reference.
It was too expensive. It was bulky. It looked not as pleasing as maybe some people wanted, and it didn't have a great response. But they've come out with a second generation now, especially the Galaxy Gear Fit model, which is a little more eye pleasing and has had a lot better response as far as people's reviews on whether or not they would wear it as an everyday technology instead of a geeky thing. So I think as we see technology form factors evolve, as we see price points come down, as we see just technology do what technology does, things are going to become better for everybody.
Several things came to mind during this discussion for me. I've seen a couple of little blips on the internet lately, and I think this is one of those things where in a decade or so, or in a while, we're going to look back and say, "Oh yeah, well, once they figured out a way to integrate this, now our lives, how are we going to live without it?" Kind of a thing. And I wonder if that isn't where we're going with this. We're just a little bit on the edge with glass.
Oh yeah, I mean, no question about it. To the question you had before, are they feeling some heat around their neck for things like glass? I don't think so. I don't think wearable technology or Google Glass is anything that Google is going to hang its hat on. It's just a hobby for them, frankly. They're just trying to keep their feet in the pool. So, if the pool starts moving, they know. And I think that's all that Google Glass is for them, just a hobby. I do agree with Amos that it's definitely wearable is definitely kind of the next big thing. That's why you're seeing all these companies kind of try and stay in that vein and buy technologies that might be applicable, because you're right, we're on the edge of that, and Google Glass may have been kind of the harbinger. That might be kind of the first major product that we've seen, and in the next couple of years, it's just going to, I think, really explode.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch that happen. I just, in the oddity realm of things, as we're kind of wrapping things up today, I did see that Google Chrome was making a lot of tin hats or tinfoil hats spin around this week. There was a vulnerability I don't even know what you call it, but it was found out that there was a Google Chrome was able to turn on a person's microphone on your computer, and then if you hacked their browser or the website in a certain way, you couldn't hear what the microphone was saying, but you could get a transcript. A translated transcript of what was being said, and I didn't. Did anybody catch that in the news this week?
Yeah, in the browser, and most users of Chrome and especially Android phones realizes a very powerful speech to text mechanism. Even in the browser, you can just talk and surf the website, surf the internet. Sorry, not the website, but what they're doing is the websites are using that functionality to tap in. So. Basically, the website, for a short period of time, gets a transcript from the browser of everything that was said around the microphone. So it's only a text-to-speech kind of conversion, too, so it's not going to pick up ambient sounds and stuff. And you have to, you know, depending on your mileage of your access and stuff, how good that text-to-speech really will. But it was reported some time ago, and Google kind of put it as a very low priority, and this week has kind of lit some fire, and they are trying to fix this ASAP.
So. Yeah, I think it came out in social media or something, so it raised a little bit of awareness. But the thing is this is a feature that people like talking to their, you know, let's talk about Siri or let's talk about whatever. People like giving commands to their phone and having it do things for them because their hands are busy or they just don't want to peck with their thumbs a long question or something. So this was just kind of a, not really an exploit or a bug or whatever of something that a legitimate use.
Yeah. And there's a demo website and, the demo website requires you to keep clicking over and over to keep it going. So it does seem to be kind of a limited time kind of thing also that the server can get the information from the computer, but it is in the end, it is a vulnerability. You could use it to eavesdrop on people. If you could trick them into your website, it's probably, you know, a low to medium, but it is something that needs to be fixed. The text-to-speech should stay within the machine. It should be a variable to just any website out there. So,
All right. As we sort of wind things down on the show today, is there anything else that that Jeff or Amos or Joel you wanna bring up in today's show? Anything going on locally or any jazz gigs coming up, Joel?
Yeah, well, you know, I think everybody's kind of gearing up for spring. There's a lot of school stuff going on that usually makes the music calendar kind of wane a bit. You know, All-State Band and All-State Orchestra and Choir and stuff going on. So I don't know of anything currently, but thanks for asking.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And Amos, it's been good having you on. Is there any tech we need to... We need to be looking out for any services rolling out in the coming weeks or months?
nothing that I was prepared to talk about. of course, there's always the super secret stuff that's coming up, but until it's announced, you can't talk about it.
So my attempt to catch you off guard and reveal secrets today on the show to spice it up for fundraising week failed.
All it does is leave me at a loss for words, which is unusual for me.
Absolutely. Jeff, you're never at a loss for words, are you?
Sometimes. I will mention this, though. There's a lot of websites and spam going around about the new SSL vulnerability we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
The hackers know about this. They're already trying to hack certain websites that are giving information about this to infect you when you go. If you do see at least for the more popular one, a bug where you get a Microsoft Defender alert, do not click on that. That is actually malware. I know on our Facebook page, I gave a couple of sites listed that you can try to see if your favorite website has been vulnerable and if you need to do your stuff. So, but do be careful, and for the next few weeks, there's going to be a lot of hype, and there's going to be a lot of messages floating around probably linking to malware to trick users because they know users are concerned about this. Just be careful and practice, you know, safe internet surfing habits.
You bet. So, be diligent in those emails. Don't fall for the link in the email trick. And let's get those passwords changed out there, folks. I want to thank our panelists for today, Matt Guru, Joel Barovalite. Thank you so much, Joel.
Thank you.
SDN sales engineer Amos Aesop was with us today. Thank you, Amos.
You bet.
And, of course, Jeff Litterick, a technology integration specialist with BIT in Peer, joined us today. I want to remind listeners, if you'd like a list of the links that we talked about on today's show, they're pretty much already out there, facebook.com/techradio.